Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Siri Jalazi. She's a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School. She holds an MBA from Harvard Business School, a master's from Harvard Kennedy School, and a BA in chemistry and physics from Harvard College. Siri collaborates with a wide range of organizations around the world, and her work frequently appears in major media outlets. Her life's work is to advance gender equality in the workplace. Siri Jalazi is also a co-author with Iris Bonnet of the new book, Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. Welcome to the Exchange, Siri.
Thank you, Mike. Wonderful to be here with you.
Well, given your Harvard credentials and the title of your book, I would be remiss if I did not ask for your perspective on the war waged against Harvard University by the Trump administration. Now, his termination of all the federal contracts with the university worth $100 million follows in the wake of forcing out the first Black woman president in the history of Harvard, Claudine Gay. What are your thoughts?
Listen, Mike, I'm not a politician and I don't represent the university in any official capacity. But as a scientist, I will say I'm incredibly concerned about the assault on academic freedom and just on the value of science and data-driven decision-making and inquiry. If I've learned anything as part of my research is that sometimes when we study things rigorously and are led by the data, we reach different conclusions than if we were to follow our gut or certainly if we were to follow ideology or feelings. So I do feel personally very passionate about making sure that we continue to use the scientific method that has proven itself over centuries now as our guide when it comes to whether it's creating medicines, discovering life-saving treatments, understanding how to deal with things like climate change, or in my realm of the social sciences, understanding how to create workplaces that are more fair.
Well, your book has quite a list of endorsers offering high praise. Melinda French Gates stands out, along with actor Ashley Judd and leaders at PepsiCo and Uber. How'd you get so many people interested in your book?
Well, I have to say we're very fortunate and very grateful to have endorsements from the likes of Melinda French Gates, Ashley Judd, Adam Grant, and others. I think it reflects a broad-based interest and passion that people have from across sectors, not just in academia, not just in advocacy, but in investing, in the arts, to create a better world, one that is more representative of the people that are actually here, but also one where we allow the best talent to truly rise to the top. Some people call this a meritocracy. In fact, a meritocracy, the dictionary defines as a system in which people advance according to their skills and according to their capabilities. The evidence is quite clear that that's not a system that we live in yet today. It's a state of the world that we'll have to create anew, but there are a huge number of people who are passionate about this.
Well, if you're open to it, I'd like for you to read a short excerpt from the book's introduction.
I would love to, my pleasure. Iris and I write in the introduction. You make work fair when you improve how you are doing the things you are already doing, your daily job, your core business. If you design safety features for cars, build them so that they work for bodies of all shapes and sizes. If you hire or promote, employ practices that have been proven to give everyone a fair shot. If you create presentations, ensure the images you select are representative of your employees, customers, and the communities you serve. And if you chair a meeting, run it so that you can benefit from everyone's wisdom. We know that in today's fast-paced workplaces, most of us are being asked to do more with less, and it can sometimes feel like there aren't enough hours in the day. So we're not going to pile on another one-off training, add-on program, or networking reception onto your plate. We are not asking you to do additional, quote, diversity, equity, and inclusion work, end quote. Instead, we are proposing a paradigm shift. When you make your work fair, it becomes part of what you already do. You're simply doing things better and smarter.
Wow, Siri, you make the process of systemic culture change in the workplace seem sort of inviting.
Well, thank you. That was definitely our hope. And I really think this way of framing the work of fairness as a fundamental part of everything that we do in organizations, rather than a separate programmatic add-on on the side, I think can unlock not only results and progress at a scale and pace that we haven't seen before, but also just a fundamental mindset shift for people in their understanding of what it really takes to create workplaces that are fair, because it is everyone's job. all of us on a daily basis are writing emails and participating in meetings or even chairing meetings. Some of us might be giving feedback to colleagues, making decisions about who gets hired or fired or promoted. And it's all of those daily actions and decision moments that are an opportunity to either reinforce fairness and create more fairness or to detract from fairness.
So Siri, you wrote, quote, "Our book will offer you an evidence-based blueprint for how to serve as an agent for meaningful structural change without making it your full-time job," end quote. That's a pretty big promise. To who are you speaking?
We're speaking to people at all levels of all types of organizations everywhere in the world, because this really is something that you can do, whether you are the CEO or the head of HR, or a mid-level manager, or the most junior member of your team. Let me give you a really personal example of this. In a prior life, before I became an academic, I was a management consultant straight out of college. And about 6 months in, and I definitely at this point am the most junior member of the team with no power to do any organizational changes. But 6 months in, I was invited to join the recruitment team and participate in recruiting interns for the company that I was working at. And they actually had me conducting some of these interviews one-on-one with interns. If I had known back then everything that I know now about what are the best practices for conducting unbiased and objective interviews, let me tell you, I would have conducted those interviews very differently than I did back then. So even as the most junior member of a team, you do control things like, what questions do I ask the interns in the interview? What words do I use in my emails? You know, if I'm in charge of updating the company's website or writing blogs for the internal website or running my employer's social media account, you have a lot of power to choose what types of people you represent in imagery, in videos, whose work you highlight, whom you give a voice to. So this really is something that we all can do. Some of us in smaller ways, and the more senior you are, you'll have an opportunity to do that on a grand scale where you can influence how thousands of people are working, not just you.
My guest is Siri Chalazi. She's a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School. And she's the co-author of Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. So Siri, according to the BLS and census data, 80% of U.S. employers are white. Why is your book needed and for who?
The book is needed for everyone because, and I think this point bears reinforcing, fairness is the work of everyone. We all contribute to the culture of our workplace through our own behavior, through the things that we do, but also through the things that we accept from others, through the things that we tolerate, through the things that we support and lift up as examples. We all need a fair workplace because in order for organizations to perform at their highest level, every organization needs the right people in the right roles at the right time doing their best work. This is what I hear consistently from organizational leaders when I ask them, what is the critical enabler or what are the critical enablers of your high performance as a whole organization? Without fail, leaders tell me it's our people. We need the best people doing their best work. And that's simply not possible without fairness. Because without fairness, we won't be able to accurately identify the best talent and bring them into our organizations in the first place. And then we won't be able to accurately evaluate and reward and advance the folks that actually are the most competent and skilled. So that is why every single person in every single organization needs to be attuned to fairness and incorporate fairness as a component of decision-making.
So I'm going to ask you an impossible question, but you're from Harvard, so here we go.
Well, let's try.
So we're now in a sixth industrial revolution, and since World War II, we have grown to become the wealthiest country in the world, GDP-wise and lifestyle-wise, the strongest military. When we look at the workplace that has grown throughout this process from World War II to where we are and has produced the wealthiest GDP, $23 trillion and climbing in the world, What I'm hearing you say is that it's been done on a bedrock foundation of unfairness. So given that it has succeeded, why should it change?
I love that you bring that up, Mike, because it turns out we actually have some really interesting data on this, which shows that since the 1960s up through 2019, 40% of the growth in GDP per capita here in the United States can be attributed to the fact that the restrictions of the 1960s are no longer in place when it comes to workplaces. So if we rewind back to 1960s, people of color in many cases couldn't participate equally. Women in many cases couldn't participate equally. It was still legal to discriminate in the early 60s in employment. It was legal to have job ads that says only white people can apply, only men to apply, right? So even before the 1960s, but at an accelerating pace since then, we've really dramatically leveled the playing field in terms of enabling more people to enter and succeed in the workplace. That work is, of course, not done. But this data proves that, in fact, we all win. Collective prosperity for all of us increases dramatically when we take down the barriers that prevent people from participating in the world of work and rising up as high as their talents will allow. That, to me, is one of the most convincing arguments for why the work of making work fair is so necessary, has been in the past, is today, and will continue to be in the future, because it's the foundation of our collective prosperity. And we can do a lot better than we're doing today.
Okay, well, you hit the ground running in chapter one with a focus on corporate DEI training, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The chapter is titled, The Myths We Need to Debunk, and there are seven that you address. Tell me about the efforts to de-bias individuals.
This is an area where behavioral science, which is my background, has a lot to offer, because behavioral science has shown that we can change people's behaviors without changing their underlying attitudes or beliefs. A lot of the very popular and widespread DEI practices and organizations, including a variety of trainings, unconscious bias trainings and others, rest on the premise that we have to change people's awareness, we have to increase their knowledge, we have to change how they think and feel first in order to then hopefully later get people to behave differently. But actually, research shows that it's incredibly difficult to reprogram our brains, if you will, or to try to de-bias our brains themselves, because unconscious bias is a fundamental facet of how we humans process information and make decisions. But the incredibly powerful insight from behavioral science is that when we instead focus on changing the context in which we make decisions, even with our biased brains, we humans can get it right, can get it better, can make more objective decisions. So let me go back to that example of hiring for a moment. A typical job interview is one where you maybe have taken a 5-second look at the candidate's resume, but then you sit across the table from them and say, okay, so tell me a little bit about yourself. And, oh, wow, I see you went to the same school as I did, or you're from the same small town that my mom is from. And now we're starting to connect, and I'm starting to like you because of things that have nothing to do with your skills or competence for the job. So science tells us that a much more fair and objective and, in fact, predictive way of hiring would be to predetermine the questions that we're going to ask in the interview in advance, and then ask all candidates for the same role the same set of questions in the same order. And then when we go to evaluate candidates' responses, let's say I interviewed 5 people for this one role, I'd look at everybody's answer to question 1 and rate that first. And then move on to question 2 and compare all 5 candidates' answers to question 2. So you see how this approach isn't trying to change my brain or educate me about unconscious bias. All it's doing is, let's tweak the process of how you take in information about these candidates and how you analyze that information ever so slightly, and help your biased brain to make better decisions.
So you believe the solution is in the process?
In organizational processes, yes. Sometimes in physical environments, you know, in a meeting setting, how we set up our meeting can have really profound impacts on who talks and for how long and whose voice gets heard. So think about a physical meeting room that has a circular table in the middle versus a rectangular table where someone sits at the head of the table. Those two scenarios connote very different power dynamics. Or envision a meeting where everyone is participating virtually as a little square on the screen versus a meeting where some people are sitting in a room together and then others are joining virtually. It's not that one is necessarily universally better or worse than the other, but they create dynamics that need to be managed. Those are design choices that we should be making consciously, and then we should know what sort of approaches the design choices call for us to make the most of them.
Okay, so you can design the process and the environment for better outcomes. We have to take a short break. Let me take a short break. My guest is Siri Chalazi. She's a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School, and she's the co-author of Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Siri Chalazi. She's a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School. She holds an MBA from Harvard Business School, a master's from Harvard Kennedy School, and a BA in chemistry and physics from Harvard College. Siri Chalazi is also a co-author with Iris Bonnet of the new book, Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. Before the break, we were talking about some of the myths in this book that you point to. And one of the myths that you point to, Siri, is that fairness is not compatible with meritocracy. What do you mean?
So as I mentioned, meritocracy is defined as a system in which people advance according to their skills and demonstrated capabilities. And I think when most of us hear that, we say, yes, absolutely. This sounds like a very valuable ideal to strive for. But meritocracy isn't possible without fairness. Let me give you an example. Around the world, we've done more than 300 so-called audit studies, where researchers send a pair of resumes to real job openings. The hiring firms have no idea that they're part of these experiments, of course. And the two resumes differ on only one dimension. So let's say one has a woman's name at the top, whereas the other resume has a man's name. Or maybe one of the resumes mentions something about being involved in the PTA, the Parent Teacher Association, which connotes that the applicant has kids, whereas the other resume is identical but has no mention of the PTA. Now, if we lived in a true meritocracy, these two candidates who have identical resumes except for one little detail should have an equal chance at getting invited to an interview, at advancing in the hiring process. But these more than 300 studies conducted around the world unfortunately show that that is not the case. If you are a counter-stereotypical applicant, say a man who's applying for a job as a kindergarten teacher, or a woman applying for a job as a software engineer, you have a much lower chance at getting called in, getting selected. Ageism remains very real. Discrimination against parents, as well as against people with career gaps or non-continuous work histories, has also been well documented. So this is just one of the pieces of evidence that shows us that decisions in the workplace and around who gets to enter the workplace are not based purely on merit, purely on people's demonstrable skills and capabilities. So when we start to be able to make these decisions more objectively and more fairly, that's what's going to help us move toward that world that is actually a meritocracy.
Well, when you say we, I keep wondering who we are. Who are we that creates this ideology of acceptable paradigms that everyone has to fit into?
Well, in my ideal world, we is all of us, right? Because all of us, even if we're not part of the formal workplace, you might be someone who stays at home, but you might manage contractors, you might hire babysitters if you have kids, right? So we're all making decisions, if not daily, then at least weekly or monthly, that influence opportunity, economic opportunity, workplace opportunity, social opportunity for someone else. And I think most people also believe in fairness as a fundamental value. In fact, that's one of the reasons Iris and I selected it as the title for our book, because there's a lot of research to show that fairness is a global and universal human value. Children as young as 4 and 5 years old develop a very sophisticated understanding of fairness and also react very strongly to displays of unfairness. So Iris and I felt that this concept of fairness can be the common ground from which we build to say, let's agree that this is a vision that we want to get towards, that we want to move towards. Now we can have an evidence-based conversation about what are the most effective ways to get there.
I do love your premise that kids believe inherently in a system of fairness, an environment of fairness, but our country wasn't established on such a foundation. Neither was our economic systems. None of our laws were established on fairness. So when you think that, or when you say that most of us believe in fairness, I'm not sure I see the evidence of that in our historical record. And another common myth you point to is your gain equals my loss. And isn't capitalism based on the economic gain of winners and losers?
So this is the idea of the zero-sum mindset or zero-sum framing. So if you win, it must mean that I lose. That, of course, assumes that the pie is fixed. So we're dividing a fixed pie or fixed amount of resources. And so if you get more, it must mean that I get less. I think the history of the world and economic history shows us that that's not a correct assumption. Because as you pointed out earlier, Mike, GDP has grown dramatically over time. So there is actually an opportunity to improve the pie, increase the pie, and thereby make it so that everybody is getting more. And the more we can bring people into the workplace and harness their talents, allow them to do work that they find meaningful, but also where they get to contribute to collective prosperity, that is going to benefit everybody.
Okay, well, we've dealt with the fairness part of your title, your book's title. Let's get to the other part of the title, data-driven design. You write about data as an engine for change. Please explain.
Yes, or data should rather be an engine for change. Data itself is not a magic wand. Just collecting numbers and having those numbers languish in a repository or some kind of database that no one ever looks at, that's not really going to drive change. So Iris and I make the point that while data is an essential starting point, to really create change, we must let the data speak. We must analyze it to identify gaps, to identify areas of opportunity, places where we're seeing unfair or disproportionate outcomes. Representation is one obvious example. Pay gaps by gender and race are another obvious example. Let me give you one slightly less obvious example. When we're talking about career advancement, I always urge companies to look at the average amount of time that people spend at a given rank before getting promoted to the next level. And if we're seeing any differences there by gender, by race, even by office, right, by location, by who your manager is or who your manager reports up to, that's a sign that we're not necessarily living in the fairest and most objective organization. And as a researcher, if we're seeing that certain groups of people are having to spend, let's say, twice the amount of time at a given role before getting promoted, that would be a signal to me to dive into the processes that are driving promotion and say, what are people, what kind of work are they engaged in at this level? What kind of feedback are they receiving? Are they getting coaching? Do they have mentors? Do they have sponsors? Are some of them identified as high potential employees early on? Are some of them getting sent to conferences and given executive coaches as a resource, whereas others are not, right? All of those types of differences could be indications of an unlevel playing field that's not actually providing everybody an equal opportunity to do their best work.
My guest is Siri Chalazi. She's a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School, and she's the co-author of Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. So Siri, how can we frame goals productively, and what happens if we don't?
Goals are one of the most potent tools in our toolbox to drive change in any realm, really. They've been studied rigorously for about 50 years, and goals have just been shown to be really helpful at focusing our attention and motivating us to achieve something that we want to achieve, whether that's spending less time on social media or losing some weight or reading more or making the workplace more fair. But goals, there's the Goldilocks principle that applies here, which is goals need to be sufficiently ambitious so as to be stretching, but not so extremely ambitious that they discourage any effort. If you're given a goal goal, especially if someone else imposes it on you, and it feels completely out of reach already at the outset, you're much less likely to strive to meet that goal because it doesn't feel realistic. I realize that in the current moment, especially in the United States, not in many other places in the world, but in the United States, goals, especially when it comes to fairness-related things, are a hotly debated topic, and the legal landscape around them is shifting. So Iris and I like to say that goals are one of many tools in the toolbox that we have to create fairer workplaces. Yes, they have been shown to be a very effective tool, but if they're not the one that you can use right in this moment or feel comfortable using in this moment, the good news is we have many, many other tools in the toolbox as well.
Well, goals are based on values. And you asked the question, how do we signal our values in the book? And what if our values, I'm asking, as a CEO or a manager, prioritize shareholder profits above everything else?
Well, I would still bring it back to fairness, because if we're going to be the most profitable organization that we can be, there's people involved. Yes, there might be machines. Yes, we might be manufacturing iPhones or computers or whatever it is. So there's going to be some inanimate objects involved. But at the end of the day, people are the ones who are making decisions. They're running the business, and they need to be the best people in the right place, making the smartest decisions. So taking care of our people and ensuring that we are actually promoting the right folks, the most competent ones, not just the ones who appear most confident on the surface, is critical to shareholder value and to financial performance. So no matter how you slice it, fairness is critical.
You also write, quote, transparency around workforce composition data is an important part of making work fair, end quote. And that reminds me of the behind-the-scenes efforts in Silicon Valley that compelled Google years ago to finally release its employee diversity data. And recently, Google settled a civil suit for $50 million, basically pennies, for an environment of racial discrimination that adversely impacted several thousand employees. So why do corporations hide their data? Doesn't that indicate there's some self-awareness?
Yes, it probably does indicate that there's some self-awareness. There's also just a willingness to present yourself in the best light. You know, this is kind of like the distinction between privately held companies and publicly held companies. Publicly held companies must share quarterly earnings reports and must produce annual reports because it's a regulatory requirement. And those requirements were put in place in part to ensure that investors have access to the information that allows them to make informed decisions about whether to invest in those organizations or not. And of course, even with privately held companies, investors typically try to do their best due diligence. So one of the other core arguments in the book is that companies should treat fairness and approach fairness exactly the same way as they approach their core business. We wouldn't dream of running our core business without tracking data, having metrics, setting goals, in many cases having sales quotas or targets, having profitability targets, having market share targets, and then of course tracking data constantly to see how we whether we're on track to meet those targets. So if that's how we manage our business, and it's sort of a universally accepted thing that business needs to be managed quantitatively, then that's exactly how we should manage fairness as well, using precisely the same tools, nothing more, nothing less.
Tell me how to mitigate bias in performance ratings.
As a general rule, the more we can increase the structure and formality involved in processes, including in performance evaluations, the less biased they will be. The more informal these processes are, the more room they contain for kind of ad hoc individual judgments, the more room there is for bias to flourish. So feedback and performance evaluation should ideally happen regularly enough that we actually remember what employees have recently done and what we're commenting on. We should ideally ask for behavioral examples and evidence for all assessments that managers are providing. So that if a manager writes a comment such as, oh, this person doesn't have executive presence, or they're not ready for promotion yet, That should be backed up by very concrete things that they've said or done that evidences that they're not ready yet or that they don't have executive presence, whatever that means. And that's another example. You know, there's a lot of terminology that floats around in performance evaluations that is biased, gendered, racialized. And the good news is technology can be very helpful with this because technology can flag some of these problematic and biased words, and technology can also hold managers to account. If, for example, they're writing a 500-word review for one direct report and only a 200-word review for another direct report, there's an inequity there because, of course, when you receive more feedback, it's provided that it's decent quality, it's generally more helpful. So technology can play a big role in helping us to gain that formality and standardization that helps to reduce bias in performance evaluations.
Well, I have about a minute left, and this is a big question. How can employers make their workplace psychologically safe? And by the way, why wouldn't that be ingrained in the culture from the start of the company?
It's probably not ingrained because we haven't consciously designed systems that actually support a culture of psychological safety where people can feel comfortable to raise contrarian points of view and challenge managers. There was a wonderful study done at Novartis where they found that in one-on-one meetings between managers and their direct reports, just asking managers to spend less time talking in the meeting, more time listening, actually helped to increase psychological safety in the team. So sometimes even to big questions like the one you just asked, the answer can be really small, simple, behavioral. Talk less, listen more.
Well, that's a simple answer to a big question, but that's all the time we have. Thank you, Siri.
Thank you, Mike. My pleasure.
My guest was Siri Chalazi. She's the co-author with Iris Bonnet of the new book, Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. I'm Mike Green.